You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Hayek Program Podcast. I'm Stephanie Halfley, a senior fellow with the Hayek Program at Mercatus. Over a series of podcast episodes, we'll explore a new edited volume, Living Better Together, Social Relations and Economic Governance in the Work of Ostrom and Zelizar, edited by myself and Virgil Henry Storr. Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009. She was a political scientist who works across the disciplines of political science, economics, policy, environmental sciences, and more. Her work on common pool resources examines the conditions when people overcome collective action problems and expands on the theory about who can actually overcome those problems. Viviana Zelizar is a renowned economic sociologist at Princeton University. In 2023, she won the W.E.B. Du Bois Career of Distinguished Scholarship Award, which is the highest honor from the American Sociological Association. Her work explores the cultural and moral aspects of the economy. Our economic lives are more complex and social than much theory would predict. In 2019, Zelizar gave a keynote lecture in our Ostrom Speaker Series, which was also the 10-year anniversary of Ostrom's Nobel. In the lecture, she tied both of their research together, explored where they differ, and where future research could go. This volume came out of that lecture and project and was published in 2023. We asked authors to engage both scholars in advanced research in this tradition, in some of the areas that they've done research or in other areas they wanted to explore. This podcast series will explore a few of the chapters and talk to some of the authors who worked on them. We hope you get the whole book and read it and see everything that comes out of it as well. In this episode in particular, I talked to Bree Wolf, an assistant professor and the director of the political economy minor at Michigan State University, and Jamie Lemke, a senior fellow with the Hayek Program at Mercatus. Their chapters explore women and the family, and I learned a lot from their discussion. I hope you do too. Thank you both for being here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Great. To get started, I wanted to just kind of get a sense of how familiar you were with the work of Eleanor Ostrom and Viviana Zelizar before this project, and kind of what your thoughts were as you dug into it. Jamie, do you want to start with you?
Sure. Well, Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize when I was in grad school, so that was a pretty big deal. And I worked with Pete Betke on some projects using her theoretical framework. So we studied policing. We did some methodological work looking at her emphasis on field work. So I've been working with Eleanor Ostrom's ideas for a while. Viviana Zelizar is newer, much newer to me. She gave a lecture in honor of Eleanor Ostrom a few years ago, and it was just so phenomenal. So it was after that that I started reading more of her work and getting more into it.
And it was that lecture that started this whole project. We thought it was so great. We wanted other people to engage it too. So
it was so good. I mean, probably most people who are familiar with the academic world at all will know this, but most people, when they give this kind of lectures, they don't necessarily focus on the subject that they're supposed to be focused on, or at least maybe, I shouldn't say most, I should say it doesn't always happen, but she did such a phenomenal job.
She really did. How about you, Bree?
Yeah, like Jamie, I was exposed to Eleanor Ostrom's work in graduate school, and I use her work sometimes now in my teaching, but I really became familiar with Zelizar's work through this project and being invited to think about the synergies. And it's been really fun to get to sort of dip my toes into the world of economic sociology and to see all the connections that I didn't know were there.
Excellent. If you had to kind of think about what was the most important things to glean from their research, and particularly combining them together, what do you think it would be?
Yeah, I really like how both Eleanor Ostrom and Viviana Zelzer take people as they are in their everyday lives. They bring out sort of less familiar or studied aspects of our lives, things that I think are hard to know if you only focus on strict empirics or data sets, right? And that is one of the most fascinating things to me. And I think it's a lot of insights, at least in my discipline in political theory, that we sort of think are true about how human beings act. But it's awesome to see this more qualitative research sort of confirming and showing contemporary relevance of a lot of those insights.
I agree with all of that. But the other angle that I would add is that they both emphasize so much the idea of rules and rules of the game or social rule systems. We could talk a lot more in specifics about that later if you like. But I think in addition to just the fact that they have these commonalities, like in the approach that they take and their attitude towards studying humanity and what they think is important, the fact that they're in two different disciplines means that you get these two people who are looking out over the same landscape, and they are looking out of different but not totally unrelated windows. So I think we get a lot of people looking out of totally unrelated windows. But the fact that they're looking at windows that share some kind of connection, bringing them together really helps get a much more nuanced picture of some of the phenomena we're studying if we can use both lenses.
Yeah, I think that's great. And it's worth saying that both of you guys come from very different disciplines as well. And so we'll kind of get some of that in the discussion today, too, with Bree as a political theorist and Jamie as an economist, me as an economist as well, but we'll throw that in there and when we can. You know, one of the things that I think was really interesting that you mentioned, Bree, is, you know, that it's like they take people as they are, and that's unfamiliar in some of the ways that we think about the world when we study it academically. And I find that to be so interesting, right? Because it's actually the most familiar and mundane things that they shed light on in our everyday life. But from a scholarly sense, it's just it had been sort of disregarded for a while. And so, you know, I think that sort of emphasis, where once you hear about it, it seems obvious, but it's revolutionary in academics is an interesting one. Jamie, in your chapter, you call the combination of Ostrom and Zelizer the connected lives institutional approach, which I really like. Kind of combining both of their senses. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what you think that, what that is and how people should think about it?
Sure. I wanted to bring in this idea of connected lives. If you read the volume, Zelizer talks about it in her chapter, but it's this idea that in trying to look at social phenomena, we can get a better understanding if we view them as interconnected, rather than if we look at something like intimacy and family, the private sphere, and the economy and government and work as the public sphere, something that's totally separate. And she also talks about connected lives being different than the nothing but approaches, which I really like. Especially since we're having an interdisciplinary conversation. So the idea behind that is, like, let's not look at people as motivated by nothing but economics or nothing but religion. You know, let's get rid of all the nothing buts. But so that connected lives piece, I think, emphasizes what is unique to both of their approaches to institutions. We have a lot of theorists who look at institutions, who look at rules of the game, at social rule systems. But what I see as a shared unique angle that they bring to that is they emphasize the connections between multiple social rule systems that coexist, that people might shift between as their identities change, and really recognizing the interaction and the relationship between those social rule systems as an important part of what constitutes society. So that's why I used that phrase connected lives institutional, because I wanted to really call attention to that piece of their approach.
I really like that, Jamie. I think, yeah, when I'm talking about institutions with my students, they can regularly name like formal institutions so easily. And they really struggle to think about those kinds of rule systems that operate outside of what we might consider formal. And then a step further, the interaction between those things. And I think it can be so difficult to think about for researchers as well. We want to sort of like isolate variables, right? And what they do is bring all the variables together. And I find that so helpful to think about, as Stephanie was saying, the sort of mundane and ordinary, but they give us a framework to analyze those things.
Yeah, and they bring them together in a way where you can still get some analytical clarity because there's still a structure to it. So it's not like you are just telling a story, but which I don't mean to denigrate telling a story, but rather than only telling a story, you're still adding an analytical structure to it by identifying, and they both include techniques in their work for how you can go about identifying the relevant social rule systems and identifying what the most important relationships between them are. So it's still very much, you know, an analytical, I guess we can't even just say political economy approach anymore since we're using Zalazar, but sociological political economy approach.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting is, you know, in many ways, we want to isolate variables to be kind of clean. We can have discussions about whether we should be thinking about causal relationships or not. Both of them kind of highlight how messy the world is, but still in a way that's like really rigorous social science. And, you know, sometimes I think the, you know, kind of academics can push back on studies like theirs because it's messy, because it's bringing the messiness of the world, but they really show a really good way forward of how to be analytically very, very strong in what they're doing and, you know, being able to make it messy, but also like really clarify what's happening in a, you know, kind of like a simplifying way that you might not get otherwise. So both of you worked on topics that dealt with family and intimacy, which is something that Zalazar has done quite a bit of, and Ostrom kind of pushing those boundaries has as well. I just wanted to get like first a sense of sort of like what motivated you to tackle that topic for this project when you started working on it.
Yeah, I've been interested for a long time in what I like to call the affective or emotional, moral, normative side of liberalism. And I think it's really a topic or a side of liberalism that's been underemphasized historically. And I think today we often sort of malign that side of liberal democratic politics as dangerous or unstable or causing conflict or these kinds of things. And so my first book project that I'm still working on is on this topic. But in Ostrom and Zelizer's work, I noticed frequent references to the family as this really crucial institution for understanding the normative in markets and liberal society more generally. And in my studies of Ostrom, I had not really heard the family often raised specifically as part of her work. And I was noticing it being raised a lot as part of what helps communities to function and to be able to organize resources specifically. And so I wanted to learn more about that. I'd also been eager to explore more of the early female classical liberals and their work. And so when I noticed some cool synergies between sort of the historical and the more contemporary, I was captivated to sort of dig in and see what else I could find.
Excellent. One of the things I really like about your chapter is it highlights the importance of Zalazar and Ostrom, but also that they weren't the first to kind of highlight some of these ideas. And, you know, Ostrom won the Nobel Prize in economics. She was the first woman to do so. Zalazar just won the top prize for sociology. So they're getting recognized, but it says a lot that these are ideas that have been around for a while, but not kind of picked up like largely within the discipline. And so being able to show the consistency of some of these ideas is great and hopefully increasing them over time as well.
Yeah, we act like these, when especially critics of liberalism, which I can say more about, act like these ideas are completely missing from this tradition. And I'm so glad that Ostrom got recognition and that Zalazar is getting recognition. But yeah, a lot of the sort of classical female liberal thinkers still aren't read regularly as part of, in political theory, we might call the canon or something like this. And so, yeah, I was hoping to sort of bring to light those ideas even more.
Bree, I loved your response and kind of what you're doing with this project. I think it's actually connected because you talked about the ideas of these early women in classical liberalism maybe not being picked up and brought into the tradition. Yeah, it's not disconnected from the laws that we've had within family and the way that those have impacted women's opportunities. So there's a book that I contributed to recently about, it's a compilation of short pieces on women in classical liberalism. And one theme that comes up quite a bit in that book, actually Leah Palagashvili in particular has an episode that focuses on this, how many women contributed to their husband's scientific endeavors. Like really famous examples would be, you know, Rose Friedman. Oh, it's terrible that I've forgotten her name, but Mill's partner.
Her first name's Harriet.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
I should be better about this as well. But Sophie de Grassy, even in my chapter, is married to the Marquis de Condorcet. Yeah. And helped with his work.
Yeah. And so that is pretty much the reason why I got interested in doing this chapter. Because for a long time, I have been interested in this question of how people can have lives that are so similar in some ways, but so different in others. So I think about two people who are so close that they sleep in the same bed at night, but yet during the day, they're walking through, in some ways, different worlds because of the way that institutions divide what things that they are allowed to do and the things that they're encouraged to do. And in Viviane Zelizer's work, she talks about status as something that bounds and defines us in that kind of way, but yet can change through the course of our lives as we change status, or it can change through legal reform that changes the rules that attach to a particular status. So it being able to read Zelizer's work and bring it into that question started to change some of the ways that I was thinking about that, you know, question that I've had and probably will have for many, many, many more years, which is trying to understand that weirdness of having such different rules to follow than the people that we're closest to.
That's great. I looked it up. Harriet Taylor Mill.
Thank you. Thank you, Taylor.
Yes. Thank you for saving us, Stephanie.
But I think that's really important. Like the idea that we couldn't, you know, like that there are these thinkers that have been throughout time, but just not the ones that, you know, kind of have been established to canon.
Well, her name's not on the spine on the bookshelf. How many times a day do you walk past and see John Stuart Mill?
Oh, yeah. I just was going to say, I think, too, often when we consider these questions in like classical liberalism or classical liberal thought, you know, we go to thinkers whose wives sort of help with their projects and sort of look at them specifically for that reason, without acknowledging that they probably are doing that because they have this influence or because a lot of their work is written by their wives. And not to denigrate that process, I think that's great that they did include those voices and had the help of their partners on their work. But then we also sort of don't look beyond that, like, okay, that checks that box. We have this consideration now, rather than also considering either their wives' writings in their own right or other female thinkers who took on these topics directly. And so that's something that sort of gets me and bugs me. I have a line about it in the chapter because we also should sort of widen our consideration and not just thinkers we already know say, okay, well, it's good that they took into another perspective. And so now we don't have to search any further. And I really like that about your chapter, Jamie, sort of bringing out the ways in which both there are different sets of rules and the way the rules shift over time in the same situations.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that really stood out to me as I was rereading your chapters is the importance of all of these ideas coming forward from scholars and thinkers that lived that experience, right? There's a reason why potentially Ostrom and Zelizer have that view and could bring these ideas into focus. this reason why the female classical liberal thinkers that you look at, Bree, do that as well. And there's a reason why the two of you are interested in that question. And it makes me think about, you know, the importance of diversity of thought and representation. But also what you mentioned is that it's not like those diversity of thought and representation are just now becoming something that's important. There were these really strong influences doing their best to get their work out there as well. And so there's also something for us to highlight who came before, right? To say that, you know, we've actually been thinking about this for quite some time. If you had to sort of get one thing across from your chapter to the readers, or maybe encourage them to dig deeper, but you want to, you know, what is the kind of really big lesson you learned from your chapter? What would you say that is? And Jamie, do you want to start with yours?
Yeah, because it relates to what we've been talking about. And so I think the big maybe message that I was trying to get across after digesting this material relates to this idea of how we interact within our families, having a big impact on how we are going to interact within the society more broadly. So in Zeller's emphasis on connected lives, or in Ostrom's emphasis on the nested nature of rules and the polycentric nature of rules, they are both illuminating these connections between rule systems. And we often think about connections between what are the rules for the market order and what type of political system do we live under. But rarely do we explicitly include family, which John Locke called the first government, because it's the set of rules that you grow up within. We rarely include that kind of in that set. But there are all of these, I'm speaking here historically, globally, if we look at the history of the way people have created social rules, really specifically defining relationships and roles within the family is a very common part of many social systems. And the rules that are set by those roles, they wind up, you know, like, just take the example of the case I focused on, which is women in the family. You have rules that women can't own property. This impacts whether or not people are going to think it's worth funding or education for women, or even permitting women to get education. This impacts whether or not women are going to then be able to contribute to particular occupations, and whether people think it's going to be worthwhile to permit them into those occupations. It just winds up radiating throughout the entire society. This actually connects to an idea that comes from another Ostrom, Vincent Ostrom, when he talks about how difficult it is for humans to behave democratically in one sphere if we're not operating democratically in other spheres. So I think that that kind of message, that rules within the family, which many people want to set to the side and say like, oh, that's just one social issue, that's just something that impacts our private lives. You know, Zelizer teaches us there's no such thing as just our private lives. That is going to impact society as a whole.
Yeah, I really love that, Jamie. And see, I was going to say something really similar about my chapter, even though we're doing approaching this subject from really different perspectives. I think we arrive at some similar ideas. So for me, sort of we've been talking about this, but I really hope that people take away from my chapter thinking about ways that liberal principles function in non-traditional spaces, or non-public spaces like the domestic sphere, but also what is required from these other spaces to allow liberal principles to flourish in public spaces. So in the sort of two cases, Sophie de Grouchy, for example, talks a lot about if we want people to function with sort of a moral sensibility, we might have to think about the ways in which those kinds of rules are learned, and not just sort of assume that people, as Susan Muller-Oken put it, sort of emerge as adults into the political space as though there hasn't been a whole life before that. And Grouchy really brings that out. And then for Martineau, thinking also about the ways in which we see all kinds of market principles functioning in whatever spaces people are in, but for women in the time that she's considering in the 19th century, especially within the home, and all that sort of market knowledge that is there that we often don't pay attention to. And then just generally, as we've been talking about, I hope readers sort of leave wanting to know more about these women in early classical liberal thought and their ideas.
I think like both of your chapters and this conversation is interesting to me, because I think about these kind of questions all the time. Like, if we're worried about democracy and power, kind of not looking at how we interact with people the majority of the time is a really interesting conundrum, right? Like, I don't have kids, but I'm interested in the way people are parenting now in a different way. And, you know, I've been reading things about like, oh, if you yell at your kid or say you have to do it a certain way, like, why would you be shocked when they do that in school and other places? Like, we're teaching power dynamics that are going to trickle throughout society. And so, you know, it's really interesting to have for so long, oh, that's private, we're not going to deal with that. Or, oh, if in the worst case scenario, the family hurts sort of freedom, liberty, individualism, markets, all of these things, right? I think we're really missing something really crucial about how we learn to be humans in society and interact with one another in a pretty crucial way. Is there anything in particular kind of in the scope of this project, reading Ostrom and Salazar and digging into your research in particular, is there anything that was really interesting or surprising that you stumbled upon in that process?
Sure. Yeah. I'm sort of disappointed to say that one of the things I was surprised about is the extent to which Adam Smith and Alexis de Tocqueville are sort of bad at explaining or even exploring the domestic sphere, and sort of poor in their analysis of women. And I really shouldn't have been surprised about that. But so many of their ideas are so helpful to me that when I started looking in these ways, because I should back up, Smith was really influential on Sophie de Grouchy, and Tocqueville and Smith were influential for Harriet Martineau. But yeah, when I really started sort of unpacking their claims in these arenas in a deeper way, I was sort of shocked at how problematic and impoverished their analysis is. I really like to ask other political theorists or people who really work with a particular thinker about the sort of fatal flaw in their ideas, or where they get the world wrong. And now I, after this chapter, have to revise things I would have previously said about these thinkers. On a more positive side, it was interesting to me the methodology, if we can call it that, by which Martineau in particular attempts to reach her readers. So she's trying to reach a different readership, women perhaps, or a less educated reader. She wants to teach them economic lessons. And so she decides she's going to write a series of stories. And it's pretty cool how she writes these stories, and she's not explicitly referencing economic theories, just sort of getting people to arrive at them through the story. But if you're looking, you can sort of find them woven throughout. It's really intricate. And it made me think of all the ways in which that's kind of how our daily lives work. We sort of learn the laws of markets and economics through our social interactions, whether we're looking for them or not. And this is one of the reasons I have so much fun teaching PPE, or in my college, it's called Politics and Markets, because when students start to see incentives and institutions working, they can't unsee it, and suddenly they see it everywhere. And I think Martineau really brought that out in her stories. Sorry, one more thing that was kind of surprising to me. When I really started looking at Ostrom on the family, and I think Jamie's chapter brings this out really well, when she's talking about the family, one of the things she really likes about, or thinks that the institution of the family does well, is that it helps enforce rules because of sort of repeat games, or there's this expectation that families will live in one place for a long time. And so you worry that your participation in communal norms it matters sort of so that your kids can also have a place in this community for generations to come. I think a lot of times we think about that idea as really outdated today. A lot of us don't live in the community in which we grow up in, but I think Zelizer's work really shows the sort of continuing relevance of these kinds of insights about the ways in which family and communal dynamics work together. So yeah, those were some different insights that I had as I was working on the chapter.
Just responding to that, I also kind of share your impression that Smith and Tocqueville were not great about this. And a lot of classical thinkers, you kind of wonder, did you not notice 50% of the people in your society? But in a way, that's an uncharitable thing to say, because when you have an institutional environment that is really doing its damnedest to try to create separation between men and women and try to prevent casual interaction between men and women, especially in kind of the, you know, the more educated, slightly more elite circles that Smith and Tocqueville would have been running in. Stephanie and I were at a conference a couple weeks ago, and I looked up the news story afterwards. So I'm not sure about the specifics. I'll say more about that in a second. But there was a student in India where there's strong separation between boys and girls in the classroom. There was an error. He wound up having to go take an exam with a classroom full of women, and he fainted. He'd never been in a room full of women before. You know, so some of the stories say it was 50 women, some say 500, but it's, you know, when you have an institutional environment that says, you know, girls study this in school, boys study that in school, women do these kind of jobs, men do those kind of jobs, we're always chaperoned if we're ever together in a romantic setting, those kind of things that would have governed kind of upper class relationships in Smith and Tocqueville's worlds. Of course, you're not going to have much of an insight into the other sex.
Well, and those examples we have of the thinkers who thought about this and were maybe they were married to, you know, kind of thoughtful, scholarly women. Often those women were deemed as like a little wild or, you know, had too much influence. And so that really highlights those separations are institutional, social, all of those things.
No, that's so helpful, Jamie. You're exactly right. And I always remind students too, like, this is not a reason not to read these thinkers or dismiss them for norms that we have learned over time or because our institutional rules have changed. But it still is surprising for me, given how, at least in my view, progressive they are on other liberal principles. But I think reminding us of the institutional setting is so important.
It's a good reminder of the fact that we all have blind spots too. But so something that was maybe surprising for me, I don't know, I get surprised a lot. I know if you're like educated on a topic, you're not supposed to get surprised by it anymore, but I still do get surprised all the time. So take from that what you will. But in my like conversations and work that I've done on women's rights to this point, I point out a lot how slow change is with respect to gender roles and women's rights, and attribute this to how deeply entrenched it is because it's rooted in the family, because these are millennia old institutions in many cases. But one kind of caveat I think I'm going to have to add to that, or slight revision to that point, is that yes, change is slow, but if you get institutional change, the change in personal relationships can be lightning fast, actually. So we can get really quick reform. People can adapt very quickly if you have the institutional change to bolster it. So two of the examples I give in this chapter, one is the case of a slave who was emancipated during the course of a relationship. And so I won't go through all the details, you know, you should read the chapter and get the full case. But the basic idea is that you have this massive institutional change in the rights that she was held to possess by law. And so then her relationship to this gentleman's family and relatives, the people he dealt with, it changed so quick. You know, there had to be lawsuits because it changed so quickly to figure everything out. Another example, this is from Zelizer's book, Economic Lives is where I got this from. But it talks about a family who moved to the United States from Mexico. And the wife's account of her relationship is that since she was economically dependent on her husband, she didn't ever feel like it was appropriate for her to turn down sex. So she always felt like she had to say yes. But this is, I opened up my chapter because I have just a short quote. This is from the woman that Zelizer was interviewing. She says, after they moved to the United States, I tell him no because I support myself. If he supported me and he gave me all the things that I need, then perhaps one might have to do what they, the men, tell you. But since here, all we women work, we support ourselves and we help our parents. This is literally like a change that happens. I don't know if it happened in a week, a month, or a year, but either way, very short on the time scale of changing norms. And, you know, I'm not like arguing in favor of less sex, but more autonomy. And now that you move into that world and she now gets to make her choice based on consent and exercise her own agency. And that happens because you move into the institutional environment of the United States where there's greater economic opportunity. So some of those relationship changes, they can just happen so fast. So in the right institutional context, reform maybe can happen very, very quickly and liberation can happen very, very quickly.
Yeah, that's a great example. You know, I think, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about social change. Is it, you know, the rules of the game that need to change? Is it sentiments? Is it all of these things, right? But I think like the examples where that changes really quickly are important to dig into and figure out. You know, there's demand there, there's willingness to adapt. And then is the hard constraint social, cultural? Maybe not in those cases, right? It's definitely something else. So now that you guys have, you know, started looking at these ideas through this lens, we'll use Jamie's Connected Lives institutional approach as the way to frame that. You know, I'm curious to, you know, kind of for you guys to think about sort of what's next in, you know, people wanting to use this approach to understand topics or explore topics of intimacy, marriage, and family. Not necessarily your next projects, right? But what do you think the next questions are that people should be thinking about who are interested in these ideas?
Sure. I think this applies to a lot of questions in political economy, but I think that a global perspective is lacking. And so I don't mean a globalized perspective, but a perspective from different societies, different cultures around the world. Especially doing this really kind of in the weeds type of research that, like Bree says, takes people as they are. You know, you have to really have a very good understanding of not just that country's laws and regulations and how its systems operate, but just of its small scale norms, what it looks and feels like to live there. And so I think research on these kind of questions from different parts of the world where there are still different levels of hierarchy within the family and different sorts of institutions upholding those hierarchies, different constraints or obstacles that maybe limit them from changing. I think research and people looking at questions of globalization and how norms are going to travel around the world and how that impacts these kind of situations. Sex work, I think, would be is obviously a research area that Zelizer's work suggests because you're looking at that relationship between money and love and looking at relationships as getting their like goodness or badness more from the quality of the institutions they're within rather than kind of their inherent nature. So I think there are a million different directions that this research could be taken from here because I think Bree will probably back me up on this, but so little has been done from especially a classical liberal perspective. So little has been done on the family.
Yeah, I really agree with that. So it will surprise everyone at this point in the podcast that I would suggest that future research could think about some of these forgotten thinkers from the past who engage these questions, or even maybe not necessarily engage these questions, but engage questions about liberalism and offer a slightly different perspective because of their lived experience, as Stephanie reminded us. But questions that are really interesting me right now, and maybe it's my season of life, I have two young kids, thinking about intimacy and the family and rules and institutions, especially on the healthcare side and the ways in which women navigate their health experience and health institutions. And so I've been really interested in Emily Oster's work on, she's an economist at Brown, pregnancy, but also in children's schooling and these kinds of family issues and interacting with institutions. And then there's a book that came out recently by Lauren Hall called The Medicalization of Birth and Death. And there's really interesting insights about navigating healthcare systems and those kinds of rules and how those influence how you decide to shape your family and what's possible for your children. And I think there's just a lot that one, on the science side, we don't know about those things, but also two, just questions we're still beginning to unpack. And I think especially from an economic perspective, a political science perspective, a sociology perspective, sometimes we haven't engaged those ideas as much as we could, or think about specifically institutions and incentives in those arenas. And so that's what I would suggest, or that's what's interesting me right now.
Yeah, that book by Lauren Hall is great. I definitely would second that.
Yeah, one of the things I've been thinking about as you've been talking is this idea of, can the family be democratic? Are there these other structures? And, you know, Bree, in your chapter, so much of the classical liberal thinkers think that the family isn't, right? It's not democratic. It can't be. It shouldn't be, maybe. And that, you know, the interaction between the two. And Jamie, you mentioned, you know, Vincent Ostrom think, you know, like about how you have to practice democracy and how it's a space for that. And so, you know, a really interesting question would be, you know, how over time we have examples of various ways the family is structured in different places and in different points in time. And so, you know, that would be really interesting to see how those impact social change more broadly as well.
And there's a book actually by a political theorist, Rita Kaganson. She sort of makes the claim that a lot of liberal thinkers, or maybe why we don't engage this question, is they think exactly as you said, Stephanie, right? That like we can have liberal public spaces, liberal states, but that relies on sort of an authoritarian family structure. That's the title of her book, Liberal States, Authoritarian Families. And it's really interesting to sort of take that question on. Like, is that true that we have to have these spaces in the way that we have first demarcated them as separate? But if it really is possible for families to have different structures or forms. Yeah.
And I wonder too, you know, as women have gotten more economic rights and, you know, they're in the political space more often, children are getting more rights and things like that as well. Like, if that's actually changed some of the shape of what families look like, right? Because all of a sudden those power dynamics have to change along with the practices they can do outside. So speaking of people that they should read next, if they want to dig into if the readers want to dig into this topic more, are there particular books that you haven't mentioned already that you would like to recommend that people dig into, or articles or thinkers kind of generally?
I think if you want to go to the original sources, Viviana Zelizer's The Purchase of Intimacy is a really good one, a personal favorite. And also her book, Economic Lives. I think those are two great ones. Eleanor Ostrom, I'm sure that readers of this podcast have already heard a lot of recommendations about Eleanor Ostrom listeners to this podcast. but one you might not have had suggested yet is her autobiographical essay, Long Polycentric Journey. It actually it explains through the ideas as well, but it connects it to her work as an institution builder and kind of how her personal history shaped that. And then I want to throw out one more kind of maybe outside the box kind of suggestion, and it's a novel by Madeline Miller called Circe. And it's a great example of a genre that I think is really having a heyday right now, which is taking stories that a lot of us know very well and now telling them from the side of the woman who in the traditional epic is just the villain or just a side character. And it's not just like a pro-woman project. It's, I think it really does get to this idea of being able to look inside it, an institution, and see how it might look different depending on your status and just how much perspective can vary depending on, you know, where we're sitting within that nested system of rules. So Madeline Miller's Circe, that's going to be my out of the box reading suggestion.
I wrote some of those down, Jamie. I hadn't thought about some of those things. I mean, I made a couple of suggestions already about things that I've been thinking about. Yeah. Yeah. And some of the other ones that I've been thinking about for sort of morals or institutions and incentives, listeners of the podcast will be familiar with. So I would suggest and often do Virgil Storr and Ginny Choi's Do Markets Corrupt Our Morals? Love that. I've been thinking about for a while and it's not new. Actually, I read it at Stephanie's suggestion, but Randall Holcomb's Political Capitalism, I think, is a really great way to think about institutions and incentives on a sort of more macro scale. More specifically for some of the things I've been thinking about with morality and liberalism or emotions and liberalism, one of my dissertation committee advisors, Michelle Schwarzy, her book, Recognizing Resentment, really takes on the question of resentment and liberal politics and thinks about Smith and some other thinkers through that lens while making some cool contemporary connections. So that's what I would also suggest. And then since Jamie gave an out of the box suggestion, I will too. I've been doing some reading groups with Liberty Fund on Hilary Mantel's The Wolf Hall trilogy. And I've been shocked at the way in which she's able to bring out sort of background parts of a really familiar story about Henry VIII's reign and many wives and the moral emotion questions and the interaction with the public, these sort of behind the scenes things. She really brings them to life in a neat way. So I've been enjoying reading that and would recommend that to readers if folks haven't thought about that.
Awesome. And hopefully listeners to this podcast are also readers. They're going to dig into the chapters you guys have and the people that you've recommended and hopefully dig into the whole volume as well. Thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. Lots to think about as we dig into this in the future.
Thanks. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you. I learned a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.